Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Welcome, everyone. Today, we're setting off on a really fascinating exploration. We're looking at the interplay between climate and human civilization in the ancient Middle East.
It's a huge topic.
It really is. We're talking a vast time frame here, from the earliest Neolithic settlements, maybe 11,000 BCE, all the way up to the fall of the Sasanian Empire around 651 CE.
A massive sweep of history.
And to tackle it, we're bringing together all sorts of evidence, right? There's the hard science, the paleoclimate data.
The proxy records.
Then archaeological finds, and of course, what the ancient texts themselves tell us.
Exactly.
So the big question really is, how did this constantly changing climate shape how these first great civilizations rose, how they adapted, and sometimes, well, how they collapsed?
It's fun, Mel, and you hit on something key there. The environment wasn't just scenery. It was an active player, a real driving force.
Right.
And, you know, for ages, the debate was sort of, was climate this all-powerful force that determined everything? Or was it more like a threat multiplier, something that interacted with human decisions, social structures?
Made existing problems worse, maybe.
Precisely. What we'll see today, looking at the evidence, is it's much more nuanced. It's a story of environmental power, yes, but also incredible human resourcefulness.
Okay, let's get into that. Before we jump into specific events, though, how do researchers actually know what the climate was like thousands of years ago? What are the scientific detective tool?
That's the crucial starting point. It all comes down to what we call proxy studies. Basically, indirect clues left behind in natural archives.
Proxy. So not direct measurement.
Exactly. We can't stick a thermometer back in 3000 BCE. So we look at things affected by the climate. And the key here is using multiple independent lines of evidence. If tree rings, lake sediments, and cave formations all point to a drought, well, then you have a really robust picture. It's about that consilience.
Makes sense. Strength in numbers. So what's one of these major proxies?
Okay, one really powerful tool is speleothem analysis. We're talking stalagmites and stalactites in caves.
Cave formations. How do they record climate?
Think of them as growing layer by layer, very slowly, from dripping water. That water carries chemical information about the surface conditions, especially rainfall and temperature. We analyze the isotopes of oxygen and carbon in those calcite layers.
Isotopes, like different weights of oxygen atoms.
Exactly. The ratio, particularly DAO, can tell us a lot about how wet or dry it was. In the Middle East, generally, more negative values mean wetter periods. And the amazing thing is we can date these layers very precisely using uranium-thorium dating.
Wow. So they're like a natural historical archive?
High-resolution chronicles, exactly. We have fantastic records from places like Sorek Cave in Israel, Jada in Lebanon, several caves in Iran like Kali Khord, Golizard, Sofular Cave in Turkey, too. These are foundational for understanding past wet and dry cycles.
That's incredible. Almost like yearly records sometimes. But what about the, you know, the really long-term picture, millennia?
Right. For that broader view, we often turn to lake and marine sediment core analysis. Lake beds in the seabed are like traps, collecting layers of sediment over thousands of years.
Mud, basically.
Well, yes, but it's what's in the mud. Dust blown in from dry areas, pollen from plants, tiny fossils, minerals. When we drill a core, it's like reading back through time.
So what tells you about climate there?
Several things. For instance, the amount and type of dust. A thick layer of windblown dust clearly signals dry, arid conditions. We can even do geochemical analysis, like the ratio of titanium to aluminum can indicate dustiness.
Okay.
The physical nature matters too. Fine, distinct layers called laminations suggest a deep, stable lake, but layers of gypsum or salt, that means lots of evaporation, so drier times. The Dead Sea Deep Drilling Project is a famous example for the Levant, Leyfan in Turkey, and the Gulf of Oman cores were crucial. They picked up that spike in Mesopotamian dust linked to the Akkadian collapse.
Dust and water levels. But what about the plants? The vegetation must tell us a lot.
Absolutely. And that's where palynology, or pollen analysis, comes in. Pollen grains are tiny, but incredibly tough. They preserve really well in sediment layers.
And different plants have different pollen.
Exactly. Unique shapes. So by identifying the pollen in a core layer, we can reconstruct what kind of plants were growing nearby. A shift from lots of tree pollen, oak, pine, olive, to mostly grass or shrub pollen tells you things got drier. Wet forest turned into drier steppe, basically.
I see.
This was key in showing the decline in olive cultivation around the Sea of Galilee during the late Bronze Age crisis. We even use it in archaeology, analyzing pollen in mud bricks or, you know, old rubbish pits at sites like Tel El Daba in Egypt. Tells us about local farming.
Fascinating. Okay, so we have caves, lake beds, pollen. Is there one method that gives the most sort of pinpoint timing, like nailing down specific years.
Ah, for the highest chronological precision, it's got to be dendrochronology, tree ring analysis.
Tree rings, right. Wider rings mean good growing years. Narrow rings mean stress, like drought.
Precisely. Trees lay down a new ring each year. By matching patterns from living trees, old timbers, archaeological wood, we can build these long, continuous chronologies, master chronologies.
And this helped with specific historical events.
Hugely. The classic example for this region is the Hittite Empire's collapse. Analysis of ancient juniper trees in central Anatolia found evidence of an absolutely brutal three-year drought, pinpointed it to 1198 through 1196 BCE.
Three specific years.
Three specific years. And that timing aligns perfectly with other evidence, like texts mentioning famine right before the Hittite kingdom vanished. It's one of the strongest links we have between a specific climate event and the collapse of a major power.
Okay, understanding the tools really helps. So now let's use them. Let's look at some key moments where climate seems to have delivered these major shocks. Where do we begin?
Well, the story of civilization here really kicks off after the last ice age, with a huge climatic shift. We call it the African Humid Period, roughly 11,000 to about 5,000 years ago.
Humid in North Africa and the Middle East.
Sounds strange now, right? But yes, rainfall dramatically increased. Areas that are desert today were savannas, grasslands, with lakes and rivers. The Sahara was actually green.
Wow, the green Sahara.
Yeah. And this wetter period made movement easier for people and animals. Crucially, it created the right conditions for the Neolithic Revolution and the Fertile Crescent. Stable water meant you could settle down, practice rain-fed agriculture. This is the foundation for villages, then towns, then cities.
So a favorable climate helped kickstart everything, but it didn't stay stable.
No, it didn't. This long, stable phase was hit by abrupt, sharp shocks. The biggest one early on was the 8.2 Karaka event around 6200 BCE. A sudden global cooling and drying spell.
8,200 years ago. What did that do?
Well, the initial interpretation, based on some coastal sites in the Levant being abandoned, was pretty stark. Climate shock equals collapse.
But it's more complex.
It usually is. More recent work, especially at this amazing submerged Neolithic village, Habonim North, off the Israeli coast.
Submerged. Underwater.
Yeah, sea levels rose later. But the archaeology there shows people didn't just vanish, they adapted. They shifted their focus, less farming, much more fishing, and using marine resources.
So innovation under pressure.
Exactly. It wasn't just collapse. It was a catalyst. It forced new strategies.
Yeah.
And maybe, in Mesopotamia, this dry spell pushed people south, towards the big rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates, where you could develop irrigation agriculture. A massive step.
So these challenges, these crises, they weren't always the end. Sometimes they forced major changes, new ways of living. Okay, speaking of big shifts, let's talk about the famous one, the Great Drying, the 4.2 Ka event.
Right, the 4.2 Ka BP event.
Right.
Around 2200 BCE, this marks a really significant turning point. The generally wetter conditions of the earlier Holocene ended quite abruptly. This was a severe multi-century period of increased dryness.
Multi-century, that's a long shock.
It was huge. It's actually now recognized as the formal start of a new geological age, the Meghalian. That's how significant this global climate shift was.
Wow.
It messed with atmospheric circulation, weakened monsoons, and for the early empires in the Middle East, it was a massive test. A cataclysm, really.
And this is linked to the first big civilization collapses.
Widely believed to be, yes. Let's take the Akkadian Empire, often called the world's first empire, unified Mesopotamia. Its collapse is a classic case study.
What's the story there?
The initial theory, pushed strongly by archaeologist Harvey Weiss, based on his work at Tell Lilin in northern Mesopotamia.
Tell Lilin, right?
It was pretty direct. He found the city was suddenly abandoned around 2200 BCE, covered in windblown dust, and this time perfectly with a big spike in dust found in marine sediment cores from the Gulf of Oman.
Dust from Mesopotamia blowing all the way there.
Exactly. The narrative was compelling. Sudden severe drought hits the north, where they relied on rain-fed farming. Crops fail, famine follows, the empire collapses. Climate is the primary driver.
Makes sense.
But further research painted a more complicated picture. Other big northern cities like Tell Brak, Tell Arbid, they didn't show collapse. They showed continuity, adaptation.
Ah.
And studies on human and animal bones, looking at isotopes, didn't show signs of major malnutrition or drastic diet changes you'd expect from total famine.
So what's the thinking now?
The consensus now is more nuanced. Yes, there was a major drought and it definitely caused hardship, but the Akkadian state likely had pre-existing political and internal problems. The drought acted as a massive stressor, a threat multiplier that pushed an already fragile system over the edge. It wasn't just the climate.
That makes sense. The context matters. Okay, so what about Egypt? Totally different system, reliant on the Nile flood. How did the 4.2K event hit them?
The link between the 4.2K event and the collapse of Egypt's Old Kingdom in the first intermediate period is much clearer and more widely accepted.
Because of the Nile?
Precisely. Egyptian civilization lived or died by the Nile's annual flood, the inundation. And that water comes from monsoonal rains way upstream in the Ethiopian highlands. The same atmospheric shifts that caused drought in Mesopotamia hit those monsoon rains hard.
So low floods.
Critically low floods.
Yeah.
For a long time, we see evidence in sediment cores from the Nile Delta, less well in pollen, more charcoal from fires, signaling drying. And Egyptian texts from that first intermediate period are full of descriptions of chaos, famine, social breakdown, even hints of cannibalism. It was bad.
And politically.
It was a massive crisis of legitimacy. The pharaoh's power, his divinity even, was tied to maintaining Mott cosmic order, harmony, prosperity. The Nile flood was Mott in action. When the Nile failed, year after year.
It looked like the pharaoh had failed.
Exactly. It undermined the very foundation of kingship. This contributed hugely to the political fragmentation of the first intermediate period, with local governors breaking away from central control. So, a fascinating contrast. In Mesopotamia, the empire fell, but society adapted locally. In Egypt, the state collapsed, partly because its ideology was so rigidly tied to environmental predictability.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh, Hannah. Perfect timing for warm chai. Let's see. Sips. A bit bitter today. Needs more sugar, I think. What do you say?
Yes, maybe a touch strong today. Still welcome, though. It's a good moment to pause before we tackle the next big climate shift.
Definitely. All right, feeling refreshed. Let's get back to it. That contrast between Mesopotamia and Egypt is really stark. Okay, moving forward in time from those first collapses, what about the Late Bronze Age? You hear about this being a really interconnected period.
Absolutely. The Late Bronze Age, say roughly 1550 down to 1200 BCE, was an era of incredible internationalism.
Mm-hmm.
You had major powers, Hittites in Anatolia, New Kingdom Egypt, Mycenaean Greece, powerful city-states like Ugarit on the Syrian coast, all linked by complex diplomacy, trade, royal marriages.
A truly globalized world for its time.
Pretty much. But around 1200 BCE, this whole system came crashing down. Widespread destruction, abandonment of cities, collapse of empires is one of the great mysteries of archaeology.
And climate played a role here, too.
The evidence strongly suggests it was a major factor, maybe the critical trigger. But again, multiple proxy records converge. Starting around the mid-13th century BCE, things turned significantly drier and more unstable across the eastern Mediterranean.
What kind of evidence?
Pollen analysis from the Sea of Galilee, for instance, shows a big drop in olive and other Mediterranean tree pollen between about 1250 and 1100 BCE. At the same time, pollen from dryland shrubs increases, clear sign of reduced rainfall. And geological data from the Dead Sea shows water levels plummeted by over 50 meters during this period. That's a huge drop, indicating a massive regional decrease in water availability.
50 meters. Wow. So how did this drought impact the big players, like the Hittites you mentioned earlier?
Well, as we discussed, the Hittite Empire provides probably the clearest case. That tree ring data, the dendrochronology, pinpointing the devastating three-year drought from 1198 to 1196 BCE.
Right at the end of the empire.
Exactly. For a centralized state relying on grain taxes from Anatolia's plateau agriculture, 3 years of no crops, that's fatal. No food, no taxes, can't pay the army. It collapses the system.
And we have texts confirming this?
We do. Those letters found at Ugarit, a Hittite vassal state on the coast. Desperate pleas from Hittite officials for emergency grain shipments. It paints a really vivid picture of the crisis unfolding in real time.
So the Hittites fall. What about the Levants, the coastal cities like Ugarit?
They were hit hard, too. Ugarit itself was violently destroyed around this time. Archaeology shows destruction layers at many sites, evidence of hoarding grain suggesting panic. And that archive is found at Ugarit, the Urtenu Archive.
You mentioned that. Letters.
Yes, administrative and diplomatic texts. They talk explicitly about biru, the Akkadian word they use for hunger or famine being widespread. Constant requests for food aid, trying to manage dwindling supplies. The harrowing account.
So this isn't just one empire failing, it's the whole region in crisis. What about Egypt? Did they collapse too?
New Kingdom Egypt survived, but it was severely weakened. The direct impact of drought wasn't the main issue, thanks to the Nile buffer, but the chaos around them hit hard.
How so?
Well, first, those complex trade networks collapsed. Egypt relied on places like the Levant for timber, metals, other essential goods. That supply chain broke down.
Okay.
But maybe more importantly, the widespread famine and societal collapse elsewhere created waves of displaced people.
Mm-hmm.
Farmers became migrants. Migrants sometimes became raiders. The groups collectively known as the Sea Peoples.
Ah, the Sea Peoples invasions.
Exactly. They launched major attacks on Egypt, trying to seize land and grain in the Fertile Delta. Egypt fought them off, but the wars were costly and destabilizing. Internally, too, there were signs of stress. The Turin Strike Papyrus records the first known labor strike in history, tomb workers downing tools because their grain rations failed to arrive.
Wow, so even mighty Egypt felt the ripples.
Definitely. The late Bronze Age collapse is a prime example of cascading failure in an interconnected system. The initial climate shock might have been regional, but its effects rippled outwards, amplified by the interdependence of these societies, leading to a systemic breakdown.
It really paints a picture of how fragility can spread. But as you said before, it wasn't just about collapse. Societies adapted over the long run, didn't they?
Absolutely. That's a crucial part of the story. The centuries after the Late Bronze Age collapse, the Iron Age, the rise of new empires like the Neo-Assyrian, Neo-Babylonian, Persian, then the Hellenistic, Roman, Byzantine periods show continuous adaptation.
How did that relationship between climate and society evolve?
It remained important, but perhaps interacted more complexly with political factors. For instance, studies suggest the big Persian empires, the Achaemenids and later the Sasanians, tended to flourish during relatively wetter periods. Favorable climate meant agricultural surplus, supporting their large armies and administration.
And drier periods.
Drier periods on the Iranian plateau often seem to correlate with decentralization, maybe settlement abandonment in some areas.
Yeah.
It suggests a link between water availability and the ability to maintain large centralized states there.
Interesting. Any other examples of adaptation?
A really detailed study looked at Anatolian agriculture from the Roman period through to the early Ottoman era. Using multiple proxies, it showed clear shifts. During the warmer, possibly wetter Roman period, you see intensified farming wheat, olives, vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
Later, during the colder, maybe drier, late antique Little Ice Age, there's a pullback from things like olive groves.
So they adjusted their crops.
Yes. But what's really fascinating is that the biggest shifts often lined up more closely with major political upheavals than with climate shifts alone. For example, the Arab raids in the 7th century CE caused so much instability.
Security broke down.
Exactly. And farmers responded rationally. They moved away from high investment, long-term crops like olives or vines, which require stability and are vulnerable. Instead, they shifted towards lower risk, faster return options.
Like what?
More drought-tolerant barley instead of wheat. And more mobile livestock, sheep and goats, which you can move easily if danger threatens rather than less mobile cattle or pigs. It was an economic choice favoring resilience and mobility in uncertain times. Climate set the possibilities, but political stability often dictated the actual strategy.
That really highlights the human agency involved. It wasn't just people being pushed around by climate. Okay, we've talked a lot about the scientific data, but what about the people themselves? How did they perceive and record these environmental crises in their own words?
That's where ancient texts are invaluable. They aren't climate data, obviously, but they give us the human perspective, how these societies understood and remembered these threats. And a common thread is seeing environmental crises as disruptions of the cosmic order, often linked to the divine.
So gods being angry.
Often, yes. Huh? Or at least a sign that the relationship between humans and the divine or the king and the divine was out of balance. In Mesopotamia, you get hints from administrative records, lower yields, etc. But also those desperate letters from Ugarit we mentioned, explicitly talking about famine.
Right.
Babylonian omen texts frequently list drought and famine among the potential disasters they tried to predict. And myths encode these fears, too. Think of the Epic of Gilgamesh, where the bowl of heaven sent by angry gods causes a devastating drought. Or Sumerian myth about a trapped storm god causing famine.
And in Egypt, with their focus on the Nile and Mott.
Egyptian inscriptions really emphasize that divine connection. The famine stele is a great example. It tells of a 7-year drought during King Djoser's reign, blamed on neglecting the god Khnum, who controlled the Nile's source. The famine only ends when the king makes amends and restores the proper offerings. Whether historically precise or not, it shows the cultural memory, framing famine as a divine issue requiring royal intervention.
A breakdown of cosmic order.
Exactly. And those texts from the first intermediate period speak very directly of the suffering, famine, chaos, the world turned upside down.
What about other traditions?
The Hebrew Bible is full of famine stories. Abraham going to Egypt, Isaac facing drought, the Joseph story revolving around famine in Canaan and Egypt as a refuge. These are often framed as divine tests or punishments, reflecting the reality of recurring drought in the Levant and the importance of the Nile buffer.
Egypt as the breadbasket?
Often, yes. And even later, Greco-Roman writers like Herodotus and Strabo acted like early environmental observers, describing Mesopotamia's fertility, the Nile's strange behavior, the Arabian deserts, and linking the environment to people's characteristics.
It's fascinating how these experiences weave into their core beliefs. You mentioned the famine stella and the Joseph story. This idea of a seven-year famine keeps popping up, doesn't it?
It really does. That specific seven-year famine motif appearing in Mesopotamian, Egyptian, and biblical traditions is quite remarkable. It seems less likely to refer to one single historical seven-year event across all cultures.
So what does it represent?
It probably evolved into a kind of cultural trope, a powerful symbol. It represents the memory of severe, prolonged droughts, maybe several different ones condensed into an archetype. It's the ultimate environmental catastrophe, the worst-case scenario, embedded in their foundational stories. It tells us more about their deep-seated anxieties about climate instability than about specific historical meteorology. So pulling it all together, the climate history of the ancient Middle East is this incredible saga, isn't it? It's about profound, recurring environmental challenges. But it's also about remarkable human ingenuity and resilience in the face of those challenges.
Right. It forces us past simple ideas of climate just causing collapse.
Exactly. It wasn't straightforward determinism. Climate acted more like a series of pressure points, exposing vulnerabilities already present in these societies.
And those vulnerabilities varied.
They did. Things like being too reliant on one food source, like rain-fed farming in difficult areas, think Acadian North. Or having very high population density, or having political legitimacy tied too tightly to environmental stability, like in Old Kingdom Egypt, or being heavily dependent on complex trade networks that could easily break, like in the Late Bronze Age.
But they also found ways to cope, to build resilience.
Definitely. We saw economic diversification, remember Hebonim North, turning to the sea.
Yeah.
Technological innovation, obviously irrigation in Mesopotamia is the huge one. And social and political flexibility, like those Anatolian farmers shifting strategies based on risk and stability. Adaptation was constant.
It really provides such a vital long-term view on how societies grapple with environmental change. The lessons in resilience and also in vulnerability, they feel incredibly relevant today, don't they?
They absolutely do.
It really leaves you thinking, you know, considering how these ancient societies literally wove their deepest fears about drought and famine into their origin stories, their myths, their religions. What new stories, what cultural anxieties might we be creating right now that reflect our own intense relationship with the changing planet today? Something to ponder. Thank you for joining us for this exploration today.